You're listening to Jackson Scanberg's Smooth Sailing. Tonight's broadcast was recorded on January 23rd, 2021.
I listened to a little bit of the last one that was done last week.
What bit were we on?
I couldn't remember. I couldn't tell you.
To start us off, why don't you tell us a little bit about your major? You're an EE, correct?
Correct. I'm an electrical engineer. Sophomore currently. Was it winter quarter? So right now, mostly just working on embedded systems and specifics about transients and circuits and RLC circuits and things like that. It's pretty fun. I dislike the embedded systems part, though, because it involves coding, and I am not a person that enjoys coding. So I'm glad that that will be done in one more class.
You enjoy coding. I find it very cathartic.
I hate it. I would never do coding for a job.
Why do you hate it? It's a very strong word.
I dislike coding because it's not something that I can physically see. With embedded systems, it's a little bit better because as you apply the code, you get to see what like physical effects happen because of it. But the coding itself, when you're writing the code and working through it and debugging, that's what I dislike, because I can't see what's happening immediately, whereas with, say, a physical circuit with a multimeter power supply, I can just touch my probes here, see, oh, hey, there's the circuit's complete, there's resistance, blah, 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 something like that. That's impossible to do with writing code on a computer. I'm more of a hands-on in that sense.
And when did you figure out, really, for the first time, you were more of a hands-on type of guy?
Probably quite a few years ago, I realized that I liked working on things with my hands, cars and things like that, building stuff, working on projects with my dad. But the one thing that really solidified that was taking computer science in high school. Not entirely sure if it was a combination of just me not paying attention or not a fantastic teacher because it was the first time teaching the class, or just a dislike in my brain for coding, but we were doing Java, and I just did not like anything that we were doing in any regards to the class.
Ben,
You're also a member of the MSOE esports team, right?
Yes.
Or one of them?
Correct.
How many are you on?
Just one. I don't really play any other games competitively other than just the Overwatch team that I'm on right now.
And what can you tell us about Overwatch?
Well, Overwatch is, they describe it, and it's a team-based shooter, so you have two teams of six. This is the normal setup. You have two teams of six, and lately what they've done the last year or so, they changed it up even more. So you have two teams of six. There are two players in each role. There are three roles. First role is tank, which is what I normally play. They're the ones that are up in the front line, soaking up the damage from the other team, and keeping the team around them, leading the team going forward, dropping back, doing what they need to do for that. The second class of heroes is what the characters are called. It's called offense, or damage even, but it's mostly abbreviated to DPS, damage per second. So they're the ones that just do the damage. Typically just that's the normal, people with guns just shooting, clicking on heads of other players. And then there's the support, group of, characters. They are supports. All of them heal in some regard, but others support the teams in other ways. They can boost stats of other ones, temporary buffs, temporary debuffs to the other team, things like that. The game is set up in a fashion that there's multiple different kinds of maps. So there's King of the Hill, Escort, and then I'm trying to think of the other one. We'll just go with those ones for now. So you have... there's a payload map as well. So on payload maps, there's a payload that moves throughout the map, and as the attacking team, someone always has to be on the payload for it to move, to go forward, and then the defending team's goal is to stop you. Then there's King of the Hill, where there's one spot in the middle where both teams have to attack toward, capture and hold for a duration of time. I believe it's 4 to 5 minutes in total. And that will be... That one plays differently than payload. You're going to have different team compositions, and you're going to have different game styles of how to attack and defend the point there. And then there's other ones called I can't think of the name, but you will. It's a little bit different, so it's kind of a mixture between the two. So there's one point that you have to get to. The defending team has to defend it. Attacking team has to get to it. Then once you're on that point, a payload will spawn, and then you push it as a normal payload map through there like that. It's a very basic overview of Overwatch.
That sounds a lot like another game, Team yes. Fortress 2.
It does, yes. There are many parallels between the two of them. You would be silly to say that they weren't similar in some regards.
Ben, do you have faith in the Valve Corporation more than you do in Blizzard Activision?
In what regard?
In all regards.
In all regards. I don't really play Team Fortress 2 much anymore. I played it probably 4 to 5 years ago when I first... it's probably more than 4 to 5 years ago, actually. 2013, 2014, I remember playing it a decent amount. I wasn't really into it a lot, though, so I didn't really get a feel for like how Valve balances the game and how they change it up during the time, because I didn't play for too long of a time period. Overwatch I've been playing since 2017, 2016, I forget when it came out. One of those 2 years. They all blend together. Blizzard has a habit of over or under correcting the characters. They don't... Even though they ask the players like what to do, a lot of the times it just seems like they focus on one small minority of the players with the loudest voice and then make changes implemented on that. I'm not entirely sure how Valve does their changes, but I dislike the way that Blizzard balances the game and all their games for that fact.
Would you rather just have them make crap than it be balanced?
Um, the game has to change for it to stay interesting, so I get why they do changes. I get why they make balances to it. But again, they, instead of changing it up in a way, sometimes there are good changes that everyone can mostly get behind, and that makes sense. But more often than not, I feel like there's a lot of changes that people are unsure about or wondering why that was even necessary. So I get that they have to change the game to keep it interesting to a point, but because it can get stale after a while, but they just need to learn how to balance more carefully, I would say. Slower.
Ben, I'm very interested on your thoughts to about Blizzard Activision stock price. Currently, it is $96. However, a different video game corporation, Electronic Arts, mm-hmm. has a stock price of $146.
Oh, so therefore now, Electronic Arts is better.
But what's much interesting about this is EA has been voted multiple times in a row the worst corporation in America.
Yeah.
Does that make Activision Blizzard worse than the worst company in America?
No. Because Activision, you can at least tell with their development teams and everything that they put care into the game. EA just kind of slaps a label on it, slaps a microtransaction, and it's 100% for profit. I still despise EA as a company and try to avoid their games as best I can.
You do not like the Origin platform?
No, I don't. Who'd have thought that? I thought it was perfect. No, the Origin platform is not good.
Why not? Don't you just love Apex Legends?
Oh, I love Apex Legends, but now it's on Steam that Origin has no purpose to exist anymore.
Yes, it does, because in order to launch the game, you have to go through Origin.
Because EA wants to shove their own launcher down our throats.
I mean, Ubisoft does the same thing.
Yep. Everybody tries to make their own launcher.
And it never works. Well, it worked for Valve, but they were the first ones, so...
They were the first ones to do it properly, for sure. They mastered it, I think.
It also really helps when two of your founders and most of your employees came from Microsoft
yes.
at their prime.
Yes. They know how to manage big projects, I would say, pretty well.
So, what do you think Valve's stock price would be right now if they were openly traded?
A dollar amount? I can't say. It depends on too many factors to say that specifically. I would imagine they would be roughly in the same ballpark as Activision Blizzard, honestly, because they do have a huge presence, and modern gaming wouldn't really exist without them, I want to say. So I think that a dollar amount to come to is kind of unfair, but a rough ballpark would say, I'd say they'd be similar to Activision Blizzard.
You're telling me the stock price of Valve would be the same as Activision Blizzard?
No, the monetary value of the company. Stock price dollar-wise, Valve would be hundreds above everybody else. Because it's Valve.
Because they own the largest platform.
They are the main distribution platform of games on the PC, 100%.
I mean, Epic Games has been releasing free games for months now, and it's a dying beast at best.
Free games does nothing if your underlying platform is bad.
How much money do you think they've burnt Epic Games?
Oh, they've burnt billions. Like, hundreds of millions, maybe. Maybe not billions. But they've burnt hundreds of millions with exclusivity deals. I remember, I don't know off the top of my head, but one of the exclusivity deals that they signed with... we signed with, was it Gearbox or whoever made Borderlands 3?
Yeah,
that was a huge dollar amount deal. And honestly, I don't think it really paid out for them, because I have friends who were obsessed with Borderlands 3. They bought it on Epic the second it went exclusive on the exclusivity was lost, it went back towards Steam, and then they bought it again on Steam.
I did that myself, actually. I also... What else did Epic do?
They don't have a shopping cart. That's one thing.
No, they don't. You have to go one by one.
Yep. Epic is just the company is just...
Don't forget about all those data leaks they had.
Yep.
Oh, what did you have to say, good viewer?
The major data leaks that Epic had really early on, where like everything you put in was lost, and if you linked specific accounts, it'd be even worse because they had access to all those accounts too.
They also had their ticketing system when they were doing refunds or something for a game. If the people on the other end of the ticketing system could see credit card information in plain text and information about other people's accounts and everything when it was just a simple refund ticket. So that was nice.
That's not even that hard to change.
It's not. Epic just, they don't care about the underlying important things that makes a platform good.
And the other thing is Fortnite's a dying beast at this point.
I don't know if I want to say dying. It's definitely not as prevalent as it used to be. It's still got quite a large following to it. I don't personally play Fortnite, but I know... I will say one thing about Epic. They are very good at making content for their games. And that's also ignoring the Unreal Engine, which is huge in game development today.
Yeah.
Fortnite and Epic as a whole are very good at making games and working on games and keeping things new. But they are not good at storefronts or being a good publisher in any regard.
It's weird because despite how much money Epic Games has, the only real store that's seriously competed with Steam has been Battle.net.
Well, not necessarily, because Battle.net serves a very specific purpose. It's only for games for Blizzard and Activision. So you can't get Blizzard and Activision games. You can get some, not all on Steam. So the games that you can't get on Steam, you have to get through Battle.net. And Battle.net they have good games on there. There are good games. World of Warcraft, for one, is still huge. Overwatch, you have the new Call of Duties on there as well. So Battle.net serves a purpose, but I disagree in saying that they are a storefront for games and game distribution as a whole, like Steam is.
I just had, or we're having a general chat conversation about Epic's monetary system, and one of the things that was mentioned by a viewer was Fortnite making million from skins and emotes. I just want to bring up microtransactions in general. What do you think about their progression? Because I remember a few years ago, they were, like, terrible.
Mm-hmm.
The days of pay to win, but
yeah,
recently they've been good. It's odd. Have you noticed that too?
I'd say it's changing a bit because there was a period of between, I would say, like 2014 to 2017, 2018, that microtransactions were really bad. They were everywhere in your face. Pay to win was key. But I think now, there's two schools of thought on it. One, people have gotten complacent with it, or people have raised such a fuss that developers realize that it actually gives them negative press. But then you have things like EA, which still manages to rake in billions a year on microtransactions alone because there are still people out there willing to pay for it. People will stay poor. People still will pay for microtransactions regardless of how much of a fuss they make because they enjoy the game.
Well, the thing about EA and Origin in general, to my mind, is even the microtransactions and everything else that EA does won't ever bring them down to a level where people won't buy their games, because the console market and the sports license in general are just too patched out.
Yeah, like, no, agreed.
They can hemorrhage all they want on whatever they want, but because of the sports license, they'll be able to keep kicking for eternity, essentially.
Yep. They will always have that guaranteed revenue stream through games, and they sign a lot of deals with movies and production studios to make games for their movies or TV shows. I don't think that's as big as it used to be in the early 2000s and mid 2000s up to like 2010 or so. There used to be a lot more movie tie-ins, and I just don't see that as much anymore. But EA had a lot of connection to a lot of those movie tie-ins and licensed products like Star Wars, especially. They still have the Star Wars IP for games, Battlefront, Jedi, New Order, things like that.
Well, speaking of licensed games from EA and Battlefront in specific, for as bad as EA is as a company, I've been very surprised with their licensed game Battlefront policies. Do you remember Disney, like, hit them up and said, if you don't start doing things correctly, we will take the license back?
Yeah, and I'm glad they did that, because they realized that that video game is it's a serious media stream. I would say it's just as serious as TV or movies nowadays in terms of outreach and interaction among players and people. So they realized, Disney's like, hey, wait a minute. These people are, the EA is getting all this negative press about one of our IPs, Star Wars, and they're like, you should fix this, EA, before we take away your license and take away all the money that we're paying to you at that of your cut. So I think it's a good thing that Disney stepped up on that. Because the new Star Wars games have been pretty good, I hear.
In the general chat, there's a conversation going on about the precedent of every company having their own launchers. I think we can both agree that that would be very annoying, and it also furthers DRM.
Yes.
But to go past that to a less obvious standard, I'm going to make a prediction. I want to see if you agree with me here. Recently, I've noticed a trend where companies have been making game subscription services. Have you noticed that as well?
Yes.
Like, EA has their Origin Access Pass, and I know what Microsoft has their pass now.
Game Pass,
and PlayStation Plus exists. It's not good.
Whatever theirs is called, even, too.
But do you think with the rise of both video streaming services and subscription services in general, that we'll start to see less, I don't know, permanent licensed games and more of a subscription-based market? For example, you wouldn't be able to buy your games. You would have to buy a pass to get the games in the pass.
I think that there is definitely a very high chance of that, because if you look at games, in some sense, I think that people are willing to pay for convenience rather than owning things in general, because renting games, renting movies and things like that, that's always been a popular thing, especially with the rise of like Amazon or Netflix, where you pay $7, $8 a month, but you don't actually get to own anything. You just stream it. It'll be about the same as that, I like to think. So you have Game Pass. I've personally tried out Game Pass for a couple months, and it is nice. Like, I didn't want to pay full $60 for Flight Simulator. Flight Simulator I had a ton of fun with, but I still don't want to pay $60 for it at this moment in time. So I did 2 months of Game Pass, and I played Flight Simulator and Sea of Thieves, and I enjoyed that sort of delivery service. However, I personally prefer to own my games outright, because I don't like that thought of, if I stop paying, I lose all my progress, or I lose all my games overnight, just like that. And if you've already paid hundreds of dollars into the service over a year or two, the second you stop paying, it doesn't matter. There's no memory on that. You lose everything. But I think a lot of people are willing to pay for that convenience, because it's the things about convenience. You have that convenience of, hey, I pay $6.99 a month or however much Game Pass is, and you have access to hundreds and hundreds of games, good games too, that you can just download and go and often have fun with. And I think that it's hard to argue with the monetary value of that.
In the chat, someone mentioned that Steam created a centralized market for PC gaming, which no one's going to argue with that. It
Correct.
Did, and yeah. it will continue to create a market as long as it hosts games that are other than Valve games, which it will, just because of the sheer quantity it has now, and it will have in the future. But further on in the comment, it asks, is it, though any further launchers decentralizes the market? Yeah, the Valve launcher does exist. Mm-hmm. But, sorry, let me get back on track. Do you think that the efficiency for the consumer, as in having a centralized market where you can have all of your games and launch all those games from, is a benefit in the loss of a competitive market where there's multiple launchers but less efficiency for the user to play those games, since you have to go through so many hoops, essentially, to even launch a game?
While I disagree with Epic and how they have gone about things, if you are a consumer who looks to pay the lowest price for a game and just wants to get a game and play it, competition is always a good thing. As a consumer, I always want to see competition, because once you have your industry leaders, Steam, Origin to some extent, Epic to some extent, you have these people that will come to the realization, hey, we're the only place where you can get this game, so why not charge more for it? They have no other choice. And that's how Monopoly is born, and I disagree highly with that. However, there is something to be said for having all your games in one place, and Steam, for instance, it's a great storefront. They have good prices on games. You can interact with people. They have good social aspects to it. I have no problem with the Steam launcher itself, but I don't disagree that if Steam was the only place to play games, that prices across the board would increase after Steam realizes that their power. And they do realize that to some extent. You have other thing. You have other places out there. Epic, GOG was also mentioned. Good Old Games from CD Projekt Red.
Yes, I love GOG.
I love it too, but GOG tends to serve a different purpose. It's in the name, Good Old Games. They have older games that are either optimized for Windows 7 or 10, but they're dirt cheap. But you can get to play those older games. You can't play those older games on Steam, because with Steam you have to have Steam integration to some extent. You have to have their Steam DRM, and older games, DRM wasn't a thing. But as a consumer, if I was looking to buy, when Borderlands 3 came out, for instance, it was $50 on Epic. So, hey, instead of paying $60 for full price, compared to Steam, why not save $10 and go with Epic? Yes, Epic has many other problems with their Epic Games Launcher, but if you are purely on a price level, I would save that $10 personally, even.
Even for the loss, I don't know if I can completely agree with you.
I'm not personally going to do that, but if I was a consumer that was only caring about price, I would do that. I despise Epic, and I will not go through Epic as long as I can, personally. But if I'm a consumer that wants to spend the lowest dollar amount possible on a game, and I see that Epic Games has it for $10 cheaper, more than not, people are going to go to Epic. If they only care about price, that's the important factor.
Yeah. It's just, I think I agree with you, but the problem is every storefront besides GOG and Steam is just so bad to use.
Oh, totally. 100%.
I take that back. Battle.net's good. I like Battle.net. Blizzard has a nice launcher. But Epic is a terrible storefront and launcher. And so is Origin.
Yeah, no, I entirely agree. Battle.net, I think they would struggle if they started adding other games. But the dozen or so games they have on there, now they do it really well because there's only 12 games, or however many few games are on Valve.net. So if they didn't do it well, it's just going to look terrible. But no, I agree. I think that they all serve their purpose to some extent. Battle.net isn't really a storefront right now. I think they're trying to change that. They just released an update that has more of that Steam/Epic look to it, where you can have more games and it's less cluttered for the games that they do have. We'll see what they do with that in the future. And we'll see what happens with Epic, too. I don't know how prominent Epic will be in the future. They definitely have a lot of problems they need to fix.
So I'd like to move on to the topic of DRM.
Mm-hmm.
Can you... Oh, we have a viewer that wants to call in. Yes, you can talk on air. Go right ahead.
Hello.
Hello, viewer. What do you want to say?
So I think that the conversation kind of winded around a little bit, but I think the biggest issue that I had with the... with the discussion, I suppose, is that I think there's a huge difference between Epic, Steam, and GOG, and Activision. Because three of those platforms, the first three, actually create a market space, whereas Battle.net does nothing except move their stuff to their own place so they can save money. That doesn't help the consumer at all. Epic provides a competitive market to Steam. GOG provides a competitive... Each one has their ups and downs, but they sell things that people can put on them, whereas Battle.net is restrictive and just serves as a company, and that's the precedent that I think is bad, is opening more company-specific launchers.
Agreed, entirely. And Epic used to serve that purpose. They would only be for Epic games, and I'm glad that they've opened up. Same with Origin as well, and GOG. Well, GOG was different from the onset. That's different. But I think more storefronts in general are definitely a good thing for the consumer rather than just company-specific launchers.
Yep.
I think the idea of having the two separate launchers, while it is still very important for just the market itself, it is also a bit of a hassle for the user themselves, because while on one hand it would be nice to make it so Steam doesn't, you know, become a monopoly and then be like, actually you guys have to pay to use our services, but everything else was killed off. It is also annoying having like, I have to have Epic open and Steam open, and they both have to be running processes in the background, which is kind of annoying.
Entirely.
And while
it's,
you know, I do
splintering the market.
Yeah. Well, I do have 32 gigs of RAM, so it's not like an issue for me. If you are like a Mitchell Hendricks, for instance, Steam takes up 30% of your computer.
That is a very valid point.
Is that loss in efficiency really worth a loss in the free market, though?
It's not something that can just be written off. It definitely has sway on the consumer. So if all my friends are on Steam, but they have more games on Epic or even more choices on Epic, there are going to be those people that hesitate to switch to Epic because if they don't have their friends or the same social aspect they've built up on one platform, switching to the other one isn't going to be as appealing as the other one, as just staying.
My thoughts on efficiency are always... I always put efficiency a bit higher than competition, because in my eyes, we were also just completely excluding the console market from this argument. We're talking about purely PCs as if they were in a vacuum, and to be quite honest, they're not.
Correct.
When we talk about Steam having a large market share, we're leaving out all of the retailers outside of the virtual space that also sell games and compete with the online market.
Yes. And with those markets, they don't have any choice. If you're on Xbox, you have to buy from Microsoft. If you're on PlayStation, you have to buy from Sony. Which does suck, and it is, there always is room in there for problems. I believe that even just the aspect that Sony and Microsoft on a more general level compete, I think that that does help to keep things in check a little bit. Because if you have Sony or Microsoft that are competing with each other, you have an Xbox who, say, has a future that Sony doesn't, or Sony has a feature that Xbox doesn't, they are going to need to catch up to each other and try to outdo each other. So there is a little bit of checks and balances in that system per se, but exclusivity in any regard on any platform just hurts the consumer.
I've always found it weird that even before we start looking at the history of exclusivity launchers, with the rise of Epic and Origin, when it was just Steam and retailers, I always found it weird that retail games remained at about the same price, like launch price for their entire lifespans. It always seems like that to me, at least, where you can always get such a better deal on Steam. And maybe it's because the PC buy-in price is so high compared to a console. And I say that with quotations around it, because it's not too much more.
Depending. It depends highly.
Yeah, it depends.
Can't be blanket statemented.
No, for sure. But why did the Steam market and how they handle sales and prices, which is quite good for the consumer, never change how retailers handled their prices? Do you have any idea why that was?
Retailers aren't flexible. They have to. There are many more middlemen in a retail scenario. Say you go to Target, and you buy a disc. You buy Call of Duty. The store itself will take a cut. Typically, in my experience at Target, anywhere from 7 to 8%. So that's 7 to 8% off the selling price right there. That's $4 to $5 that they're four-ish dollars that they're losing. Then you have to pay money to print the disc, print the case, print the label for it, transport it physically, logistically to the store, and then you have to pay the developers along the line too, and then the company who actually makes the game, and the publisher, they all take a cut. So as Steam, as a distributor, they don't need to take nearly as much of a cut. It depends. I'm not sure what Steam takes as a cut off the top of my head. But I bet since Steam was seeing all these retailers with their prices, even though Steam has lower overhead than retailers, if the retailers aren't going to lower their prices and people still buy from Steam, Steam has no incentive to lower the prices. They can just make more profit off of it while keeping at the same price, because they have less overhead.
I just looked it up. For the first $10 million in sales, Steam takes 30%. For between $10 and $50 million, it takes 25%. And past that, it's 20%.
So that's a pretty high margin, actually. I'm not sure, at the end of the day, when you break it down, which method of delivery of game distribution provides more money back to the development company. But I feel like with Steam, with physical overhead, it's a lot less. They just have to pay for servers. They don't have to pay for that distribution chain.
What do you mean, what does Steam give in return?
So you're saying Steam gives like 20, you know, they take 20 to 30% of all your profits, and for what, like server hosting? But what if you host your own servers? If you are using them to host your servers, if you're using them for like, that's actually it. That's all I could imagine you're really paying them for. But for 30% of your profits at max, for most of the people that are actually selling stuff on there, that's a little insane.
That is quite high. It is quite high margin, even though they do provide a great service in regard, the social aspect, workshop, all that stuff. 30%, regardless of how you slice it, that's a big chunk of change gone.
especially when we're talking quantities of the millions, like 30% for the first $10 million. If your game never even hits $10 million, it's going to be 30%. And that hurts indie developers greatly.
It does, and that's why some people, and that's why Epic was only charging 20%, I think is what their cost was. And developers like, hey, wait a minute, why put a game on Steam when you can put it on Epic for save 10%? 10% across millions of dollars is huge.
And when we're talking about what games Epic's handing out, most of them are indie titles. I mean, they started off with GTA, and then recently they did Battlefront, and I think they also did a couple larger games in between. I think they handed that out, but that's several years old at this point. Most of the games Epic has been handing out are indie games, so that's where, if they're going to strike Steam, that's what they should target for sure.
Yes and no, because it goes back to the problem before. You have Epic and you have Steam. Steam, across the board, has a better platform than Epic does in terms of buying and social experience. So you have indie developers who the first thought in their mind is Steam. Steam has a huge player base. They have a huge outreach. And if you want your game to reach bigger audience, as an indie developer does, why not put it on Steam? Sure, you'll lose some profit, but you'll get a much bigger audience at current times, for the most part, because Steam is such a much bigger platform than Epic is.
Well, that's only if you're an... How do I put this? In my eyes, there's two types of indie games, and I don't know if you see this as well. There's the marketed indie games, the mainstream, and then there's the indie games, if you understand what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
it also goes back to how easy it is to get a game on a store.
Yeah.
If you're a big company with a big platform, but you only allow in a small portion of people, or a company with such and such requirements, you're not going to be able to get your game out there to the audience. Steam's requirements are basically bare minimum. Sure, they take a higher cut, but in terms of getting the game on a store, that can't always be overlooked.
Going completely off the rails on this topic, will Nintendo stay permanently exclusive to their own consoles for all time? I mean, recently they branched out into mobile very, very slightly.
They will always stay. They have stayed that way for the last 40 years. They're not going to just change. Nintendo as a company realizes this because Nintendo game is quintessentially Nintendo. You can't replace a Nintendo game. You see Mario, Nintendo. You see Mario Kart, you see Zelda, Nintendo, 100% of the time. That kind of market mind share cannot be replaced. Nintendo knows this. That's why they can still charge 4 years after the fact that Breath of the Wild was released, they can still charge $40, $50 for it. And can still charge full price, release price for a console because they know that Nintendo is Nintendo, and you will always get that sold. You will always get those sales. People will pay for it because subjectively, Nintendo does make good games. I've thoroughly enjoyed many Nintendo games, and they are still some of my most favorite memories in terms of video gaming, and that cannot be replaced as a company. Sure, they are allowing other developers and games on the Switch because they do realize that, to an extent, the Switch is a different console from other home consoles they've made in the past. Switch competes more with mobile, and mobile games have much more choice. If Nintendo only allowed Nintendo games on the Switch, they would be at a disadvantage in that sense. So that's why you have things like Doom and Skyrim on the Switch, because it is a big market, and Nintendo's not dumb. They're going to realize they can make money off of it while still preserving their brand image at the end of the day, which is what Nintendo covets most, which is their brand image.
Yeah. Someone said that Nintendo literally represents Japan, and
100%.
That's very well put, because if Nintendo represents Japanese media worldwide, they're a very close parallel to how Disney now becomes a sort of American monopoly when showing American media around the world. They're at, what, 70% of media owned?
Disney owns a huge chunk of media. They have huge control. And that's what Nintendo does in some parallels. They have huge control over the games. They control the entire process from software to hardware. So they can develop a game. Hey, we want to develop a game specifically for the Switch. That's where Breath of the Wild came from. That's where newer games that work with the Switch and Switch only came from. And when they work with the Switch very well, they tend to be pretty good games. And Nintendo is known for their quality and game making, which is Disney in the same aspect is known for a lot of the times for good movies, memorable movies, children's animated Pixar movies that is that are quintessentially Disney. You see a Disney movie, hey, that's Disney. Or you see something that looks like, you see even something that looks vaguely like a Disney movie, hey, that's 100% Disney right there. And you know that instantly. And that mind share, again, is key to a company.
Yeah. A viewer was just saying that Nintendo is known for their cease and desist.
Yes.
Yeah. It's...
very much so.
Yeah.
They...
No one's going
to
argue.
They are going to protect their copyrights and trademarks to the teeth. They will cease and desist people on YouTube posting speedruns and arguably raising awareness for the game, which is basically only positive for the company. But Nintendo can get very caught up in only caring about themselves and their brand image. So they will send cease and desist to people and tell them to knock it off, even though what they're doing can either only help Nintendo or can't harm them in any way. But Nintendo will always do that because that's what they do.
It really says a lot about Nintendo when you like think about all of their awful mistakes that they have made and how it kind of spins back to hurt them. Like, going back in my memory, they made the Wii U. And then they go straight into the Switch, which has now become, what is it? I'm going to look it up. One of the best-selling consoles of all time.
Not surprising at all. They've sold more than the Xbox One, I believe. They were constantly outselling them for years.
Yeah, it's already approaching... No, this has to be... This feels outdated. Yeah, this is outdated. I can't find an accurate number, so I'm not going to say anything.
Okay. It's just very popular. We'll say that.
Yes, very much so.
I think what we should take away from it is just disregard Nintendo.
Yeah. Well, I mean... I might also have this wrong, but they accidentally resulted in the PlayStation being born, from what
yes.
I understand.
Sony approached Nintendo, and Nintendo backed out because Sony didn't do what Nintendo wanted them to do. So, or it might have been the other way around. I'm not entirely sure how it went down, but Nintendo and Sony were paired up. They were going to release a console called the PlayStation. They split ways, and then Sony went and made their own, which is now competing with Nintendo in some fashion. There are ways that Nintendo will still always have a stranglehold on the market because they're the only ones that fill that spot.
Well, one of the spots that they fill just in general is the portable market.
Yeah. PlayStation and Xbox have never been able to break into that. The Vita, PSP, they were good tries, but they just won't ever have that same support as Game Boy, DS, 3DS, which is, or Switch even, it depending on how you argue the Switch is. They fill that mobile segment, and that mobile segment is huge. As a kid on road trips, you play with your DS or you play with your 3DS. You don't play with a Vita or a PSP anymore.
Yeah, I mean, Chet just said that he says Nintendo fills a casual niche, and when he says casual, he means like Animal Crossing and the Pokemon games.
Mm-hmm.
That just Sony or Microsoft will never be able to fill with whatever they pull out.
No.
And that relates back to the portable market. I mean, Animal Crossing and Pokemon were portable exclusives up until the Switch. I mean, there wasn't a mainstream Pokemon game on a console until, what, last year, the year before?
Yes.
Same with Animal Crossing.
Mm-hmm.
And
no, that's not true. Animal Crossing first released on the GameCube.
GameCube, yep, that's right. And they also had a Wii game, I believe. But when you think of Nintendo series that have exploded in popularity in recent years, they all, like, basically come from the mobile market. I mean, Fire Emblem was a dead series until it went to the 3DS.
You can also say the same about Zelda because, well, no, actually, not even that's not true either, because Zelda was first on the NES. Never mind. Disregard that.
Do you think that there should be some sort of mobile competition to compete with? Well, it wouldn't even matter if there was competition to compete in the mobile market because Nintendo's still going to hold those properties. And as long as they make good games of those properties, they will still have the strength.
And like I mentioned earlier, PlayStation has tried. I'm not aware of a Microsoft attempt, like serious attempt at the mobile market, but PlayStation and Sony have tried, but it'll never take off as Nintendo. It just won't. Nintendo's got that casual stranglehold done.
What do you think about this idea? Xbox Game Pass on mobile. Somebody just commented that.
It's an interesting concept because the game, to have a mobile game, you have to make the game on the onset to be a mobile game. If you typically porting a full console game to a mobile platform does not work out well. There are aspects of the game that are lost, whether that be graphical, gameplay. It's an entirely different platform that you can't just port back and forth to. So Game Pass, I think, will be interesting because Xbox, from what I remember, is optimizing and porting some games. They're trying to do it properly. So it'll be neat to see what they end up doing with that. It'll never be as big as Nintendo. Mark my words on that. It just won't because Nintendo is Nintendo. Xbox Game Pass on mobile, just it's not going to approach Nintendo.
What do you think about Nintendo opening up a theme park, a part of a theme park in Japan? Did you hear about this?
I have not, actually.
They partnered with Universal to open up what's essentially, you know how Disney has, like, their, like, Frontierland and Fantasyland sort of things,
mm-hmm.
like theme sections of amusement parks. There's a Nintendo Land at Universal Japan that's going to be opening up. And we're going on commercial break.
You're listening to Smooth Sailing with Jackson Scanberg on 101.1 FM, WJEB.
Go ahead.
You're listening to 101.1 FM, WJEB.
Milwaukee's Classic Country, 10-4.
That was, for anyone listening, Take Me to Milwaukee by Babe Miller, I believe. And I just wanted to remind people what we were talking about previously. I believe it had something to do with Nintendo Land, the theme park that's going to be built in Japan.
Yes.
I, quite frankly, have no idea where I was going with that. So, we're just going to go back to something Nintendo-related, I suppose. Ben, have you ever heard of the Mario 64 speedrunning incident involving an ionizing particle from outer space?
I cannot say I have heard of that specific speedrunning incident, no.
Supposedly, in Super Mario 64, there was a speedrunner playing on the level known as Tick-Tock Clock, and during the course of one of the stars, he upwarped, as in Mario was teleported several, I don't know what the unit of measure in Mario 64 would be, but several quote-unquote meters above where he was standing inexplicably from what people assume to be an ionizing particle from outer space changing a 1 to a 0 in the it would not be a disc because Nintendo 64 had cartridges, so in the cartridge.
That is a interesting thing that might happen. I would assume that Nintendo builds in protections against that. Of course, you're always going to have memory that develops errors, but that seems like a very specific error that I don't know if it would actually make it through or not.
Yes, viewer. The speedrun still did count, but it wasn't a world record or anything, so it's not like it mattered.
Speedrun doesn't count unless it beats the previous record. A speedrun doesn't really matter.
It's personal best, which I don't believe it was. This was a one-off incident caused by supposedly an ionizing particle coming through the atmosphere from outer space and hitting this particular cartridge.
Jackson, do you think aliens could have assisted the speedrunner?
That's what I was about to propose, Mr. Bill. Ben, reason aliens would want to help a speedrunner?
Aliens would not care about a speedrunner at Mario 64.
Why do you think aliens have no interest in speedrunning?
I don't think they have any interest in speedrunning because it doesn't affect them. As an alien species, if they had enough capability to detect us and read into us that much, they're not going to care about such a little thing like that. They are coming here for one purpose specifically. Either that or they're just ignoring us. But in terms of even playing a joke on humankind, I doubt they would do something like that.
What's their one purpose, Ben?
Either to take us over or just leave us alone.
Then are the pyramids an element left over by the aliens to take us over?
If they haven't at this point, why have they waited so long? If they haven't by this point, why would it matter then?
Maybe they just didn't see anything in us yet.
That's entirely possible as well.
Maybe they're waiting for us to achieve some breakthrough before they make any contact. And by contact, I mean actually give us anything of use.
Maybe. Or why would they want to help us? I'm going to ask you this now. Why would they want to help little humans on a little planet in a solar system?
It would provide great entertainment value to their people.
That's valid.
I mean, are you telling me that aliens would not want to watch a program of a bunch of essentially highly evolved apes running around and doing stupid shit for 2,000 years plus. Actually, it's closer to 10,000.
It would be very interesting to watch, I think, from an outside perspective. Just as it is now, for someone to go back looking at history and realizing how stupid some things were or how funny some things were, or irony not being lost over hundreds of years, I think it's interesting to go back and look at stuff like that. And I think the aliens would feel the same exact thing about little human apes running around.
Okay, let's suppose it was a TV show, okay? It's this 10,000... You know what? Let's set a date to this. Let's say this is a nearly 8,000-year-old TV show going on right now, spanning just before ancient Egypt emerged.
Yes. Okay.
And the only contact that aliens have had with Earth are on one-off incidents where technical difficulties with the filming equipment have occurred, resulting in crop circles, or during the early years of the show when the first pyramids were built. That's the scenario, okay?
Okay.
Sort of like the Truman Show.
Sure.
What do you think their favorite arc of human history would be? First of all, you want to divide human history up into seasons?
Yeah, we can definitely do that.
Okay, so let's say that season one was the BC season.
Okay, rocks, sticks.
Okay. What would season two be?
Season two would probably be medieval time, I would say. Because it depends. There's eras that we as humans break up. Stone Age, Copper Age, Bronze Age, things like that. As an alien species, do you think they... I don't know how much of a difference they would be able to tell between our seasons, to put into that term. How would they break it up? Would they look at, say, hey, now they have skyscrapers, let's designate this as a different time, or would they just look at the entirety of the last 20,000 years and say, hey, oh, nothing really different has changed, they haven't blown up entirely yet, so nothing new is going to happen. Well, I think as an alien species, they could break it up into some things, but as humans, we break it up in different ways.
Well, here's how they would do it. So the BC would be the start off. We would have seasons like BC, and then large periods of time, like the medieval ages, would be season two, and they would probably go up to maybe the start of the Renaissance. But in that time, you would have arcs. So the Bronze Age would be an arc. The Stone Age would be an arc, and we're going to commercial again.
Back to commercial.
You are listening to Jackson Scanberg's Smooth Sailing. Tonight's broadcast was recorded on January 23rd of 2021.
All right, we are back after that brief break. Ben, so I just finished explaining up how seasons and arcs would work. What do you think the favorite arcs of the aliens would be? Ben? Ben, are you there?
Oh, yes, I'm here. My apologies. I think one of their favorite arcs would be, to an alien species, I think they would probably just get the most joy out of watching us fight, I would imagine. I don't think they would have too much care for just watching us go about our day-to-day tasks, which, with honestly the last 50 or so years, has been mostly what it is. There haven't really been any huge world-changing events that are physically able to be told. So I think you can take a look at the world wars, and I think that would be probably their most entertaining, or even maybe old medieval wars, too.
I don't know. I think personally, what they would like to watch is sort of the build-up before the fighting starts. I think they would get a real big kick out of watching the Black Hand prepare to assassinate Franz Ferdinand. I think that would be, like, they live for the tension. They're not living for the incident, in my opinion. Like, it's when you see an action scene in a show. It's nice while it happens, but the real juice of it, to say, is watching to see what's going to happen next. And for that reason, I think the Cold War arc is the aliens' favorite.
But has the Cold War resulted? Well, yeah, I suppose. I feel like, in terms of story and depth, the build-up to a war is more interesting than the war itself.
Well, I think their favorite episode of the show, which from here on out, I believe it would be named something like Monkey See, Monkey Do, or something along those lines, would be the Cuban Missile Crisis episode. Tension from start to finish. One of the classics.
I think the Cuban Missile Crisis was a very interesting arc to watch. Even just to go back and read on now, all the connections and how things played out, how they worked with each other, I think that was very interesting.
Do you think aliens will ever intervene to continue the TV show if it ever got to that point?
I think they'd only ever intervene if they started to be threatened in some regard. If we started to become an interplanetary species, which hopefully we do. I don't know if we will in my lifetime. Maybe the beginnings of it. But I think the aliens wouldn't care until they were directly threatened.
Could you see a scenario where they would like cancel the show out of boredom or... No.
They would just zap like the that. Planet then.
Ben, have you ever read A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
I have not. I want to, though.
Do you know what happens in the first chapter of the book?
I do not.
Can I say what happens? Because
go ahead, yeah. I need to read it at some point. That's okay, if it's the first chapter.
It starts off with Earth being destroyed because an alien council decides that the solar infrastructure of where Earth is would be better used for an intergalactic highway. So they just wipe us off.
I mean, as an alien species, we don't matter to them. If they have those capabilities to be worldwide, interplanetary, intergalactic even, doesn't really matter. Humans, we're nothing. We're insects. You don't think of that fly and its connections when you go to kill a fly, if you do kill flies. Yeah, they're not going to really care.
And do you legit believe in aliens? Not the aliens we're describing, the aliens in general. I didn't even ask you that.
I'm not entirely sure. I don't want to say no, but... we don't have any evidence. I think it's interesting. We haven't had any proof of aliens existing, but we also don't have any proof to say that they don't exist. So I think we're still kind of stuck in the form of, yeah, they could. And I'm not going to say that they don't. So I'm going to say on record that I believe that aliens could exist because I don't have evidence to the contrary or to join along with it.
Ben, if we made contact with aliens, do you think racism would end and speciesism be born?
So humans versus aliens then?
Yes.
Okay. I think that, in a sense, yes. To some sense, yes. I think humans fundamentally are flawed, that there always will be some sort of racism and prejudice, stereotypes toward other humans. But I think if it was humans versus aliens, that there would be a large, there would be a more driving force for humans to work and try to fight back against the aliens. I think that there would still always be racism toward other human beings because it sucks, but it's a human thing that just happens. It's entirely wrong, but it's in our society in total and it can't be ignored, but I feel like it would decrease dramatically once we all come together for a common goal.
Well, a viewer just joined and then proceeded to leave after that rant. Also, that got a lot darker than and more serious than I expected.
So, aliens could exist, and in an aliens versus humans scenario, I think that humans would come together more so than they ever have in the past, but there would still definitely be cracks in humans. There.
Ben, what are your thoughts on ghosts? Do they exist?
Thoughts on ghosts. In my entire life, I've never had evidence that ghosts exist. Although actually, I'm not sure. Again, another one where I want to keep it open, and I'm not going to deny or confirm it, though. I feel like people, when they come up with ghost stories, a lot of them can be very far-fetched, but there are also some that, you know, make you think that, hey, maybe, just maybe. So, going off of that as well, same with aliens, I don't want to say no. But I don't want to also say yes. I'm open to it if it does happen.
Ben, speaking of ghosts, or really this has nothing to do with ghosts, but bringing it back to a more serious topic, since the rise of social media and billions joining these platforms, we have to acknowledge that these people are taking up server space, obviously, 100%. No one's going to disregard that, but do you think, how do you think people should handle the matter of interrupted twice. Let me start again.
Yep.
And just simplify it. How do you think we should handle people passing away on social media platforms because they're taking up space, but is it right to get rid of them?
Taking up space. To just outright delete the account?
Yes. This is, okay, so this is a, I let me tell you how I came up with this.
Okay.
So I had a friend that passed away a few years ago.
I'm sorry.
His account is still on Steam. Offline. It's been offline for about 2 years now.
Okay.
When is it ever okay to remove him? To disappear him? Is it ever okay? Because I don't think it would be ever okay to disappear this guy that I knew.
What kind of standpoint do you want? Do you want it from my standpoint or from a company standpoint? Are we going to go along the lines of delete a person once they die, or what? So, as a company, I'll go back to what you were saying earlier. As someone who dies on social media, and their account still exists, I don't think it's right to delete that account because a lot of people with social media, that's a mark that they leave on the planet. You're not going to just go ahead and erase someone's memories from photo albums, get rid of them. Regardless of how you think of someone, it's trampling on their on their legacy. And I'm a strong believer of someone's legacy should definitely be preserved once they die, because they can't say anything for or against it. When you die, you have no control over it. So what should happen from social media companies, granted they take up server space, sure, fine. They take up server space, but as a tech company, as a social media company, you have to plan for these things. You're not going to just go around thinking, oh, hey, we're running out of server space, let's delete a bunch of accounts. Sure, companies have done that in the past, and there are ethical and personal concerns that people have with that. But there's always going to be more storage space. There's always going to be more hard drives. There's always going to be more solid state. I don't think social media running out of space on a platform is something that's really going to be a concern. So I don't think that social media companies should delete deceased people's accounts, no. Or get rid of them in any regard.
What I mean is, not right now, but we're talking, there's 7 billion people on the planet right now.
Correct.
And let's say there's close to 7 billion accounts, 7 billion social media accounts on Facebook. I don't know how many are actually on Facebook right now. That's something I could probably figure out. But think about it like this. There are billions of accounts on Facebook right now, all taking up server space.
Yes.
Within 70 years, or I shouldn't say 70 years. I use the term 70 because let's say people are at least 10 when they use social media. So let's say, and lifespans will probably improve over the next century.
70 is an accurate number, then.
70 is fairly accurate, but those 14 billion accounts, all of their first users will be deceased. And Wyman brought up in the chat, it's kind of a different topic when I talk about Steam rather than social media. And I like to disagree there, because if you're using social media, granted you don't have any physical product that you bought, but in my opinion, you're also being sold. So, like, who you are has been sold off to other companies. So I believe there is some monetary connection to these accounts.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the difference is that one is you're buying in and the other is you're being sold out. But moving past that,
depends.
Do you think, how because I don't know that there is any precautions put in place by the major social media companies or even online platforms in general for what happens when their server spaces are slowly, like, compiling with more dead people than alive people.
Yeah.
Because that's what's going to happen.
Eventually, yes. Yeah, no, you're entirely right. Eventually, and I feel like as a social media company, there's already billions of dead, there's already millions upon millions of deceased people's accounts on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. I feel like what they're doing now, in terms of, they don't really delete accounts. I feel like at this point, why would they change? At this point, current in time, but maybe in the future when the deceased accounts do outnumber the alive accounts, maybe they state going forward, hey, in this account, who can be your recovery account? Like Google does this. When you lose access to an account or when your account's going to be deactivated, they alert someone. Maybe social media companies start requiring people to do that. So you say, hey, I'm gonna put my sons or my daughters or some other younger person than me who's likely to live longer, I'm going to put them in charge of my account when I die and leave it up to them. I think that social media companies should maybe start implementing that at some point if they want to think that far ahead of time. Because I don't think it should be up to them. It shouldn't be up to the social media companies to decide what to do. It should be up to friends and family of the account owner Because even though an account is dead, the user of an account is dead, there is still some incentive to keep it on the platform. You have accounts who have posted very popular things, say on Twitter or Facebook, things that are shared a lot. I feel like that can add to a platform in its whole. So I feel like just blanket statementing, we should delete all deceased people's accounts, I feel like that's a little bit short-sighted on a company's end.
I mean, you also have to consider that these are now, for any future historians that may exist, these are now primary sources.
Correct. No, it's definitely a primary source, and you have all these perspectives and interesting things that are posted by individual people that would just be lost if you deleted that. Granted, stuff like that does happen in history. First-person sources, they get lost over time. But as a social media company, they're in a unique position that it's up to them entirely if they want to be lost or not.
Really, I think... I don't know what... Because I think what's going to happen is we're going to see some sort of legal battle in the future where it's going to be who has the right to essentially these people that are now gone, that are their next of kin, or the company that they, the first user, essentially subscribed to join, signed the user agreement to join whenever they first made their account.
Well, maybe that's just something they have to make the consumer aware about. You would have to state when you're signing up your account, hey, when you die, or when you're deceased or your account's inactive, we can delete it. And then that's on the user at that point to take a look at that. Like, hey, maybe I don't want that to happen. Maybe I do want to send it off to a beneficiary and let them decide.
Well, Facebook does have this. It's called memorialize. You have the option to essentially set the user's setting to deceased and then either choose to remove their account or memorialize them.
And I think that's a good thing, because if you have a particular person that the benefactory determines, for whatever reason, they don't want that account active on the internet. They don't want that account on the internet anymore. They have the sole power to get rid of that. But if you want to like highlight it, hey, this person's deceased. Here, take a look at their life. See what they've done. See if they've posted throughout the years. I think that's also a very interesting concept that they should play around with. And I think that should remain an option for social media accounts going forward, because it is something that you do have to think about. We think about 10-year times. Oh, I'm not going to die in 10 years. A lot can change in 10 years, and you never know what's going to happen.
Wyman just posted a picture of what it means to memorialize someone on Facebook, and it's fairly interesting if you want to go look at it. But how do you think... So, social media, I'm going to now go back on my statement and agree with Wyman now that social media and games platforms or platforms where you purchase things are now going to have to be considered two separate subjects, because I believe that if you purchase a product, then you would then have to decide who gets it. Do you think we'll see the rise of handing out accounts and wills? Like, do you think that you will have to decide which one of your next of kin gets access to your Steam account?
I think that's definitely a thing that does happen. I've heard stories, and I've read stories of people online who have had large media collections, and only they knew the password, they knew the login, so when they died, they genuinely put it in their will saying, only this person is allowed to see this password and get access to the account, and they can do whatever they want with that from there. I think definitely going forward, as we become more and more technologically involved as a society as a whole, that I definitely think that we will be seeing more wills including internet accounts. I think that's definitely a total possibility, and I could totally see me maybe doing something with that in my will at some point. I'm not sure.
Ben, what would you Do you have any accounts that you own that you consider as, like, a joke that you would bequeath to someone?
Oh, 100%. Oh, yeah, I would totally do that. I have a couple email accounts and Gmail accounts that I have just not serious at all. The entire thing is just made to be just a joke, and I would totally send that off to people. I would totally do that to people.
Who's going to get your MySui account?
Nobody. That I'll just let them delete that one. That one doesn't matter.
I believe, do they already delete it? You would know. You're in IT.
It is interesting to think about that as going forward of what to do with deceased people's accounts and content. It'll be interesting to see how that becomes more prevalent, because it's had to be dealt with before, but it's becoming more and more prevalent as time goes on.
And I brought this up initially because I was just considering server space, because let's say every user currently is now deceased, then you have to at least double your server space to get all the new users you're going to have. But there's already excess space because people are always creating new accounts continuously. And even going past that, technology is going to improve going forward. So I'm sure that there will always be space, like you said.
There always will be, yeah. It's not in a company's interest to run out of space, ever. They need to have that open availability.
I mean, if you look at drives, right, over time, even in the 80s, you had, like, whoa, 1 megabyte drive. We have 100 terabyte SSDs now that are the same size as a traditional hard drive. So, really, I don't think running out of space is something in our future. The amount of space that we're able to put into the same size drive increases so much every year.
It is such a data-oriented society. Running out of space will never be an option. It just always will be. There will always be open space somewhere. On the internet. At your home. Always internet. Always open space.
Can you believe we got to this topic from ghosts?
We started off with talking about video games.
That's true. But after the commercial break, I'm surprised you haven't listened to an entire Smooth Sailing, but we've stayed in the ballpark of the same topic the entire time. The alien things were a little bit out of left field, but even that was connected to Nintendo through a way.
Yeah, in a way. Is there always going to be a theme on Smooth Sailing?
Probably not. This is probably just a very lucky stream where everything was coherent.
Okay.
But, yes, we've so far always asked our guests about ghosts and aliens.
Okay. Interesting.
Someone suggested I ask about Denver International Airport, which I don't know that much about. I know something about they built hangars and buried them.
There are conspiracy theories that there are large underground fortifications / storage facilities underneath Denver International Airport.
I was also shown the apocalyptic drawings that used to be on the walls of the airport. Oh, what conspiracy theories do you believe, Ben?
Interesting. How conspiracy? Like, are we talking, like, known programs by the CIA, MK Ultra, and stuff like that? Or are we talking, like, really out of left field, lizards run the planet?
Well, no, not confirmed isn't even a, like...
Well, that's what a conspiracy theory is.
Let's put it like this. Let's say not confirmed, but there can be evidence.
Okay.
Like, for example, let's just use the Denver International Airport. There's pictures of the bunkers that they buried, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the hangars. But they've never been confirmed. So, let's just say, not confirmed, even if there's very much video evidence even on file of it.
Interesting. I'm trying to think of some conspiracy theories I believe in. I think the Russians have done some very questionable things, but that also can just stem from, or sorry, the Soviets, that can also just stem from how closely guarded they always keep secrets. One of the interesting ones that I'm fairly certain a lot of people have heard of is Dyatlov Pass. It's a mountain range in Russia. And a bunch of hikers, I think there were like 7 or 8 hikers, went there in the 70s, early 70s, 80s, maybe 60s even. I'm not entirely sure of the date. But there were a couple hikers that went out. These were experienced hikers that kept journals and were very focused and knew what to do. So they weren't inexperienced hikers. They knew how to camp in the cold, how to work in the cold, and everything like that. So they go hiking, and within a couple days, they were about halfway through their journey. They told people about it, so people were aware. It wasn't just a secret trip. They were going hiking to a mountain. I forget what the mountain is called, but it was something ominous, like Death Mountain or Wolf Mountain or something. I can't remember specifics. So these group of hikers, they go out one night, I think like halfway through the hike, they were all in their tent for the night and hanging out. They were writing notes. You had journals, consistently normal, totally normal hike up to this point. Then they're in a valley. Dyatlov Pass is the name of the valley. And they're discovered a couple days later, that the hikers had some really weird injuries and deaths. They all died. They were all dead. They were all discovered dead after they didn't return home. And so there's theories about how they died, because there are some inconsistencies across the stories. Even the medical examiners who examined a couple of them were unsure about some ways that they died. There are some conspiracy theories about it. People say aliens, others say they did it to themselves, they did something like that. My theory, conspiracy theory, in a sense, might not be the most interesting one, but I tend to believe in this one, that the Soviets were maybe not necessarily deliberately doing it, but the area that they were hiking in was considered basically abandoned and barren. No one lived around, so the military could do what they wanted, really, and get away with it, because Russia's so big. It was in the middle of Siberia. It didn't really matter in that area. My conspiracy theory, in a sense, is that the Russian military was testing some sort of device, weapon, not entirely sure. Simply, they were testing some sort of ultrasonic / maybe radioactive, I'm not entirely sure. It's the point of the conspiracy theory, that they were testing some sort of weapon in the middle of nowhere where these hikers were, and the hikers just got caught in the crossfire. I think this because some of the injuries that the hikers had weren't necessarily blunt trauma injuries that could just occur, say you fall or are attacked by someone. They were more internal. So there were some people that had internal bleeding with no apparent injuries on the outside. There were some that had injuries that weren't really able to be explained by any normal circumstances. There are two of them also were discovered with mildly radioactive clothes, but that was because those two worked in a radioactive plant. So I know that part's not necessarily true for a conspiracy theory. That part's been confirmed. But my conspiracy theory that I hold is that the Russian military was testing some sort of ultrasonic weapon that could do harm to people from far away with no external signs of injury or attack. That's the one that springs to my mind first.
Ben, do you know the concept of a neutron bomb?
I do, yes.
Do you believe the U.S. has one?
Of course. They're easier to build than a nuke.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Even though that there's supposedly an agreement that no one should build one.
International treaties don't matter when you have secretive military branches. If no one figures out about it, they can't know. Yeah, 100%. I totally think that any country that has nuclear capabilities also has dirty slash neutron bombs, because it really is just explosive wrapped with some radioactive substance that, once broken up into smaller pieces, is dangerous and deadly. So you can just put conventional explosives, a big bomb, say a Moab or something, and you wrap that in a highly radioactive substance, but not to the point of where it becomes a nuclear bomb and the explosion is atomic, where it's just a conventional explosion, but the goal of it is just to disperse immense amounts of radioactive material, which can cause arguably more damage than just a regular nuclear bomb, depending on how you look at it. But oh, I 100% believe that worldwide countries have multiple neutron and dirty bombs.
Well, someone brought up that a neutron bomb by definition is still thermonuclear, but that doesn't really add anything to the conversation directly, just a fact. For people that don't know what a neutron bomb is, though I'm pretty sure a lot of people in here already know, or why it's called a dirty bomb or a neutron bomb, is imagine if the radiation was invisible.
It's all the radiation without the boom.
Yes.
Of a nuclear bomb.
Exactly. And if detonated underground, the city would just die.
It would leak into the water, leak into the food, sewage. It would just be everywhere.
It would be as if someone detonated the radiation of Chernobyl underneath your city, and then people just started dropping and no one knew why.
Yep. 100%. The goal is to disperse as much radioactive material in as large of an area as possible to cause extreme amounts of human harm and damage.
Well,
without destroying physically the city itself like a normal nuclear bomb would.
And the reason people always bring up nukes is not because of the explosion, but the radiation. I mean, the difference between what we dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the Moab we dropped in 2016 is only the radiation. It's the ability to rebuild the zone afterwards is the only difference between using a nuke and not using a nuke.
Correct. So nuclear test sites in Nevada and Kazakhstan, where most of the Soviets tested their bombs, they'll be uninhabitable for thousands of years. Same with Chernobyl, same with Fukushima, some parts of like Three Mile Island and other nuclear disasters. The radiation will last. The majority of the radiation is gone within about 30 to 60 years, the deadly radiation. So you can still walk around Chernobyl now, walk around Pripyat and the surrounding area. Yes, the radiation level is higher there, but it's not necessarily to the point of what it was in the 80s where it would kill you within days like it has.
Oh,
but radiation's scary because you can't see it. Can't smell it.
Speaking of places where no humans inhabited, do you know about Six Flags New Orleans?
What? No. I don't.
Sorry, I need to go on a tangent because this is one of my favorite stories of all time.
Okay.
After Katrina hit,
mm-hmm.
The city would not rebuild Six Flags New Orleans. And Six Flags, being the cheapest amusement park company in America, did not want to foot the bill to repay it either. They abandoned the complete amusement park.
That's a shame.
There is a Six Flags sitting out there, not completely operational, but completely accessible to people. And the weirdest part is, since it's been completely abandoned, wildlife has started to occupy it, and it's super interesting because you'll just have literal alligators and crocodiles. Well, alligators or crocodiles, I forget which one,
mm-hmm.
inhabiting a Six Flags park as their new habitat.
That'd be awesome to go see.
The pictures are amazing.
I'll have to definitely look that up after this. That's pretty cool. Imagine just leaving a completed amusement park. Seems like such a waste. But if the nature can return and go back to that, I think that's interesting to see how nature would intermingle with whatever humans have left behind.
What I see amusement parks as mechanical engineers trying to flex their hardest.
Well, duh, yeah, it's a huge opportunity for someone who designs roller coasters or other amusement park rides. Yeah, it's the most hands-on experience that you can get with someone who engineers that, and I feel like that's as MSOE students, that's very timely and very applicable.
I wonder what someone brought up Imagineers. You know what that is, right? The people,
yeah.
The engineers who design Disney parks.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how much they get paid.
Well, the parks have done really well, so I imagine all yep. the people along the line are compensated very generously. I'd hope so, because they do make some great parks.
And it has to be less mechanical. Don't quote me on this, but it has to be less mechanicals and more of a mix of electricals, mechanicals in the ECS spectrum now, because a lot of parks are moving to, I don't know what to call them. Do you know what they are? The screens where it's not animatronics and a mechanic. The track is mechanical.
Yeah.
Animatronics have been replaced with.
So like an augmented reality kind of thing?
Yeah. Augmented reality
okay.
screens.
I think that's definitely, you have to, instead of everything being all physical now, you have more of a blending between majors. Even as a student now, what I do as an EE nowadays with embedded systems and coding and stuff, it wasn't really a thing 50, 60 years ago because new majors have come up just because of how technology has evolved, and I feel like in the real world, when you're applying that to, say, an amusement park, you do have to have that spectrum. You have to have that spread, because if not, you're going to be behind. Because, sure, physical amusement parks are fantastic, and I love them. But, you know, it never hurts to split up, and it never hurts to experiment and try some new things with augmented reality or some more mishmash of modern technology with old stuff, too.
I mean, Disney's a unique case in itself because they have a living city. Like, when you look at Disney World, we're talking about a place with literal tunnels connecting the, I don't know how big it is in square acres. You know about the tunnels, right?
Yeah, no, the tunnels that have to connect everything so that Disney employees can't be seen by the public as they walk around.
Entire area, all the infrastructure in Disney World is the second floor.
That's pretty impressive.
Which is insane. And they grow, they have farming communities to provide their own food to their own park.
Oh yeah, you have to. Once you get to that big of a logistical headache, you have to do everything yourself. No other company is going to be able to fulfill that for the cost that you're probably looking for as Disney. It's definitely in their interest to make their own things on site because they have the capability to do so and they have the demand. I think Disney World's fascinating. I've been there a couple times. How everything's all interconnected, but it's all entirely different. They've definitely done a fantastic job with crafting that entire area, not necessarily one theme park, but seven or eight of them. They're just all really well done.
It's just impressive because people see it, it's the perfect example of forced perspective. There is no better place in the world to see forced perspective than Disney, especially what engineers have been able to do in conjunction with forced perspective. Everything is quote-unquote fake.
Yeah, no, it's about putting up that illusion of just you're not you're just in a different area. It's fascinating how people respond to that and how when you go to an amusement park, how things just shift and change. Especially Disney does very well with the atmosphere and blending things together to just make it work.
Do you think in Nintendo's amusement park they'll have giant cartoon characters of like Toad, like obscure?
They better. I really hope they do.
Do you think they'll do like the costume character things in Super Overact? Do you think you'll have Toad screeching and harassing kids?
Oh, I really hope so.
I hope on my bucket list is going to that Nintendo Land. And being harassed by Toad. We're going to commercial.
Okay.
My name's Mitch Hendricks. This radio station broadcasts out of my dorm room. I am getting brain cancer for your enjoyment, so you better take advantage of it by tuning in to WJEB on 101.1.
I cut it off a bit too soon, Ben. But it is 8 o'clock. This is usually when the program ends.
Sure.
So, Ben, is there anything you would want to say before we wrap this up?
I just want to say thank you for having me on. I had a fun time.
Oh, it's been an honor, Ben. It's been great. This has been the most cohesive podcast we've done so far.
I'm glad you had me on. It was an interesting and eye-opening experience for sure.
Well, anyways, this has been Smooth Sailing on 101.1 FM WJEB. We will be signing off for the night. I hope you have a good night. We'll be back maybe next week, maybe the week after. We will see. We have no scheduled guests for the next time. We'll figure it out. Keep your ears open and your eyes open for something on Discord or in person to hear about.